This is an ABC podcast.
Good morning. Welcome to AM. I'm Sabra Lane. The United States has formally declared Russian forces have committed war crimes in Ukraine as President Joe Biden prepares for a series of high-stakes meetings with European allies in Brussels. Leaders are expected to announce further sanctions against Russia, while NATO is poised to send more troops to Eastern Europe. North America correspondent Jade McMillan reports.
Boarding Marine One for the first leg of his European journey, Joe Biden gave little away about his preparations.
What would you like to say to European partners?
I'm going to say that to their face. I'm going to say all I have to say, I'm going to say when I get there.
The White House has already set the scene, though, for a packed agenda in Brussels, where the president will attend an extraordinary NATO summit, as well as meetings of the European Council and the G7. They're all aimed at bolstering Western alliances almost 4 weeks since Russia's invasion of Ukraine began. And as Joe Biden reinforces his warning that Vladimir Putin could be considering the use of chemical weapons.
I think it's a real threat. Thank you.
In another attempt to isolate Russia, Western leaders will use the meetings to unveil further sanctions as well as a tightening up of existing measures, while NATO partners are expected to again step up their defences. Around 40,000 troops are already stationed between the Baltic and Black Seas, with Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg flagging further reinforcements on its eastern flank.
I expect leaders will agree to strengthen NATO's posture in all domains, with major increases to our forces in the eastern part of the alliance, on land, in the air, and at sea. The first step is the deployment of 4 new NATO battlegroups in Bulgaria, Hungary, Romania, and Slovakia.
On the eve of the European meetings, the United States has formally declared that Russian forces have committed war crimes in Ukraine, following on from Joe Biden's comment last week that he believes Vladimir Putin is a war criminal. Beth Van Schaak is the Ambassador at Large for Global Criminal Justice at the US State Department.
We'll continue to track reports coming out of Ukraine of war crimes, and we will share this information with our friends and allies and with international and multilateral institutions as appropriate.
From Belgium, Joe Biden is expected to travel on to Poland, which is bearing the brunt of the humanitarian crisis and where thousands of American troops are already stationed. But he won't be stepping foot in Ukraine, a prospect considered far too risky while the war is still unfolding. This is Jade McMillan in Washington, reporting for AM.
With soaring prices, the great Australian dream of owning a home is still a struggle for many. As we wait for the federal election to be called, the Property Council has released research showing most voters believe young people will never be able to break into the market. But as Stephanie Boris explains, don't expect big campaign announcements from the major political parties about it.
Susie moved back in with her family 5 years ago so she could save up to buy a home.
It's just soul destroying because you feel like you've got your house deposit ready to go and then there's a huge jump in prices again.
The single mum who works full time wants to buy in a capital city but concedes that's no longer possible.
I'm looking to buy somewhere regional at this point because anything metropolitan is just ridiculous.
Property Council Chief Executive Ken Morrison acknowledges more people are struggling to get into the market.
Housing affordability has just got to crisis stage in Australia, and it's time that all levels of government had a laser-like focus on coming up with solutions.
The council is launching a campaign to try and pressure the major political parties to do something about it. It's released survey results showing 68% of voters are concerned that younger people will never be able to afford a home.
Quite often politicians talk a big game on housing affordability, but the announcement really only have piecemeal impacts on outcomes.
But tackling housing affordability is unlikely to be a priority during the election.
No one wants to upset the apple cart, particularly for older Australians.
Independent economist Nikki Hutley doesn't think the Coalition or Labor wants to annoy people who already own homes.
more people own houses, or at least part of one, than don't. And so if government changes policy to make things more affordable, they also then impact the wealth of those that have their foot in the door.
Labor learnt that the hard way at the last two elections when it campaigned on changes to negative gearing and capital gains tax. Those policies have now been dropped. And while a federal parliamentary inquiry last week suggested giving people access to their super as security for a home loan, most of the recommendations were aimed at state and territory governments.
So one of the things I think we really need to be very focused on is around planning regulations and also around the supply of social and affordable housing.
The Coalition has schemes to help some first home buyers save for a deposit or buy with a smaller one, and Labor has promised to build 30,000 low-cost houses over 5 years.
Is a good step in the right direction, but it's not going to solve the problem.
Ken Morrison from the Property Council says at a federal level, much more needs to be done.
I think this issue is now elevated beyond just being a state or local government issue. What we need is solutions to get outcomes.
For now, people like Susie will continue to work and save, knowing that finding a place to call home will be life-changing.
Not having to worry about where we're going to live, because that is a worry of mine.
That's Susie, who's trying to buy her first home, ending that report by Stephanie Boris. Families with loved ones in a Melbourne nursing home say their experience shows just how little things have changed more than a year after the final report from the Aged Care Royal Commission. Five families spoke with AM about declining standards and staffing issues at Bupa Aged Care Templestowe, particularly in the dementia unit. The provider says some of the problems are due to COVID, but the families say the pandemic is being used as an excuse. Social affairs correspondent Norman Hermont reports.
We're losing this best carer.
These are the voices of people who've decided to speak out about the care of their loved ones at a Melbourne nursing home, Bupa Aged Care Templestowe. Litsa Beck's father, George Poulos, is 87 and has lived in the home's specialist dementia unit for 7 years.
I was expecting specialist dementia care. I was expecting a workforce that were highly trained. That is not what I found as time went on.
She says even before COVID, standards were declining, but she was shocked after an incident in December when her father returned to the home after being in hospital. Visitors were barred due to COVID, so Litsa Beck called to check he'd returned safely. She called again the next day.
Late afternoon, I rang again, and the nurse on duty was telling me that they couldn't get him out of his hospital gear.
The nurse arranged for her to visit.
I found him in his chair asleep with just his gown and no pants and just the nappy that he had on from hospital.
Bupa said in a statement that due to privacy laws, they were unable to provide details on Mr. Poulos. Litsa Beck is not alone in her concerns. In all, five families with direct experience with Bupa Aged Care Templestowe spoke with the ABC, including three women whose parents reside in the 12-person dementia unit. Sarah, who doesn't want to be identified, and her father and brother make two visits a day.
My mum would be dead today if family carers were going in to look after her.
Sarah says the dementia unit has become much more reliant on fill-in agency staff.
They call them up, you know, they come in to work for a shift or two, you know, a week here and there. They don't know the residents.
The families who spoke to the ABC are adamant the staff are not to blame, saying they either do not have adequate training or there simply aren't enough of them. Bupa said in a statement that due to COVID, we have had to engage agency employees to cover unplanned absences. Bupa also says it prioritizes the use of permanent staff in the dementia unit. In 2019, Bupa's CEO apologized after an ABC investigation revealed numerous failings at aged care homes across the country. Bupa told the ABC it's made significant improvements since the period from 2018 to 2020, when 15 homes were under sanction by the regulator. Only one home is currently under sanction, but 11 homes, including Bupa Templestowe, have current non-compliance orders for not meeting standards. Mara Pagato's mother died last year after spending 3.5 years in the dementia unit at Bupa Templestowe. She says her mother struggled that whole time, and any improvements she'd hoped for after the Aged Care Royal Commission haven't materialised.
We've spent taxpayers' money, millions, on this Royal Commission, And what's come out of it? I don't see anything. I see staff cuts. I see poor quality in food, poor quality in care. Nothing's changed.
Mara Pigato, ending that report from Norman Hermont. Let's return to the war in Ukraine, and there's growing concern that the city of Cherniv, northeast of the capital Kyiv, could become the next Mariupol. Russian forces have blown up a bridge into the besieged city, cutting off a vital corridor for water and other supplies. In Mariupol, the situation remains dire, but Ukraine's famed Azov regiment says they'll defeat the Russians. Correspondent Barbara Miller reports.
New drone footage of the port of Mariupol shows a city in smouldering ruins. It was supplied by the famed Azov regiment, accompanied by what sounds like a poem. This is Mariupol today, it reads. People are breathing here, hungry in the basements of burning houses. Their hearts are still beating under the rubble in the hope of salvation.
Slava Ukraini!
Glory to Ukraine, begins a social media post from the Azov Regiment's deputy commander, Sviatoslav Palamer, in Mariupol. He gives an update on the latest developments on the battlefield. Then the commander speaks directly to an international audience.
How world can you sleep when the civilians of a peaceful city and seaport of Mariupol are under constant fire? Was it tasty, the steak you ate today? Possibly you are deeply concerned and worried about the situation in Mariupol, but there are not your citizens. Why do you need to hurry up?
The Azov Battalion emerged in 2014 when Russia annexed Crimea. It was a volunteer militia which attracted ultranationalists and neo-Nazis. It's credited with retaking Mariupol then from pro-Russian separatists and has since been elevated to a regiment of the National Guard. Mitro Koharchuk is an Azov battalion commander in Kyiv. He joined the battalion in 2014 and then went back to his civilian life. But when Russia invaded last month, Dmitro Koharchuk rejoined.
We want to live, we want to be happy, but Russia, they want to destroy us.
He rejects the suggestion the Azov regiment is a neo-Nazi group.
We have no neo-Nazis in Azov. We have nationalists of Ukraine. We have doctors, engineers, teachers, a lot of people of different professions, but no neo-Nazis. And I think that we will win in this war.
When? How long will this war last?
I don't know. I'm not analytic, but we have victory now. We have victory in our minds. But the whole victory may be next few months, maybe next year.
Dmitry Koharchuk got married and ran a business in the years since 2014 and now. The 31-year-old says he'd like to have kids, but he can't think about that right now.
Because tomorrow or in few weeks and or months, I also can be dead.
All he's thinking about, he says, is saving his country. This is Barbara Miller in Lviv reporting for AM.
With so many people displaced in Ukraine, there's a huge humanitarian effort underway. Médecins Sans Frontières is there as well. Its deputy emergency coordinator in Ukraine is Alex Wade. He says it's trying to boost the Ukrainian health system's capacity to deal with the fallout from the conflict. And he's speaking here with David Sparks.
Well, so currently I'm in Dnipro, which is in sort of the center east of the country. We came here because we want as much proximity as possible to the areas with the highest needs. These are areas like Mariupol, areas in the south, and then also towards the east, where there's active fighting, where there's hospitals that are receiving high numbers of wounded, but their supply chains have been disrupted. So we're trying to work with these hospitals, get them as much supply as possible, and also be here in Dnipro, which is a hub where displaced populations, people fleeing violence, are settling before they move on elsewhere or before they try to stay here in order to get away from violence. So this is a strategic place for us to be so we can respond to all of these needs at once.
Okay, let's go into a little bit more depth about the work that you're doing. As I understand it, your main task is to help local health workers train, prepare for what's coming?
Absolutely. Ukraine has a very developed health system, but no health system in the world is really designed to prepare for such a large-scale influx of needs, especially when the supply The medical supply chain throughout the country has been disrupted, so you have an increase of needs, but a decrease in the regular systems that supply those needs. So we're working with the local health authorities, the local health system, to identify what their needs are. In many places, it's supply, making sure that the supply keeps coming in for them to respond to the increased needs of the wounded coming in, but also of displaced populations with chronic diseases, elderly populations who need continued access to care for chronic diseases and need access to medications. But another big issue is that receiving, let's say, 30 wounded into a hospital at once is a particular skill set of how to triage very, very quickly, make rapid decisions on how you can save as many lives as possible. And it's the type of experience that most hospitals in a peaceful setting don't have because it doesn't really happen very often. However, these hospitals are suddenly faced with that type of scenario.
What kind of dangers are health workers, including aid workers, facing at the moment where you are?
Listen, where I am in Dnipro, it's safe, as safe as many of the major cities in Ukraine are right now. But the big problem for us is the areas where the needs are the highest, where we want the greatest access to be able to respond to those needs. Those are the areas where either we don't have access at all because it's too dangerous, or the areas where we can access, but in a limited capacity and not to the extent that we would want in order to respond to those needs.
That's Alex Wade, the Deputy Emergency Coordinator in Ukraine for Médecins Sans Frontières. He was speaking there with David Sparks. A couple of days ago, when the Australian Defence Force's new Space Command was officially launched, it was clear the government's keen on developing it into a separate branch of the military, just like the US version. The man chosen by Donald Trump to establish the US Space Force says his nation would be very willing to help with that. General John Raymond's in Canberra for talks with Australian defence officials as concerns grow about the activities of China and Russia far above Earth. Defence correspondent Andrew Green prepared this report.
Today, space is essential not only to our way of life, it's absolutely critical to the modern way of war.
Established in 2019, the US Space Force now boasts around 7,000 uniformed personnel known as Guardians and another 7,000 civilians. They're led by General John Raymond, who was appointed as Chief of Space Operations by then-President Donald Trump.
I'm very comfortable that we can protect and defend our capabilities today. But the reason why we established a Space Force and the reason why these partnerships are so important to us is we want to move fast. We want to stay ahead of those threats.
General Raymond's just arrived in Canberra for talks with Australia's military leaders. Both nations have identified Russia and China as the main threats in space, following recent demonstrations of their abilities to destroy satellites.
We don't think it's safe and professional for China to use their DN1 weapon system and blow up a satellite, or Russia to do the same thing. We don't think it's safe and professional for countries to put capabilities that are concerning in close proximity to other countries' satellites.
This week, Australia's long-awaited Defence Space Command officially began operating, and Defence Minister Peter Dutton has flagged it could one day become a fully-fledged space force like in the United States. That would mean it would be a larger and separate service within the Australian Defence Force alongside the Army, Navy and Air Force. General Raymond says he'd be happy to help.
Absolutely. We want to be partners in any way that we can be helpful. In our country, the Air Force was responsible for space since the 50s. As we've been in the past and as Australia is to us, we want to be helpful.
Professor Stephen Freeland is a space law expert who is this week travelling to Vienna to co-chair United Nations working groups on the peaceful uses of outer space. The Western Sydney and Bond University academic believes establishing strong global consensus on how nations should operate in space is essential.
Nobody wins in a space war. Everybody loses. And I think that's a powerful message that no doubt people understand, but don't necessarily espouse publicly, given that the geopolitical times where military rhetoric is one thing that is regarded as important by various elements of society.
Space law expert Professor Stephen Freeland ending that report from Andrew Green. That's AM for today. Thanks for your company. I'm Sabra Lane.
Hi, I'm Sam Hawley, host of the ABC News Daily Podcast. As the fighting drags on and the human toll grows in Ukraine, one of Russia's closest allies, China, is being accused of complicity in the invasion. Today, former White House policy advisor Professor Evan Medeiros on China's dilemma and why the decisions it makes now could lead to a change in world order. Look for ABC News Daily on the ABC Listen app or wherever you get your podcasts.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.